Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Orphaned Entertainment. This is Christopher, and as always, I am joined by Lydia. Welcome, Lydia.
Thanks, Christopher. Excited to be here again this month.
I appreciate you stopping by again. We have a third guest with us today because we're going to do a little different to this month. Instead of doing some films, we've decided to look into radio programs, and we have a friend that is very much into the radio program and the audio drama. So please welcome Steve.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for joining us, Steve. I know you are a fan of the audio drama and radio programs, are you not?
Yes, love them, love them. I think they you know, they call it the theater of the mind, right?
Right.
You know? And I really, really like that genre, yeah.
Well, and I, you know, being that we are kind of wading through public domain media, there is a lot of radio available under the public domain banner. This is just one of those things that, of all the things, film, books, whatever, radio just, it fell in there quick. So there's a ton to go through. So I definitely did not want to ignore it. I want to come in every now and again and pick out a few episodes and talk about them, because they are definitely, a lot of these things are fantastic and definitely worth the time. And short, the ones we're going to be discussing today are only a half an hour apiece, thereabouts, broken up with little musical interludes every now and again. So it makes it very easy listening. So if you can, you know, put them into your podcast or what have you, that makes it even easier.
Not to be confused with easy listening music.
Yes, no, not to be confused.
But no, they are there. I was actually surprised. I haven't dabbled in radio drama since I was in college, but I was surprised to find myself very entertained by all four of these that we're looking at tonight.
Oh, fantastic. Now, the four that I am, or that we are going to discuss, I found from the relicradio.com, which is a site pretty much dedicated to sharing these types of things. They can also be found on various other places. Archive.org, I know, has them. Many other websites have them because they're a public domain. There is a lot of people that are big fans, so it's easy to find, and it's easier to find people. If you find one that you really like, a particular show or a genre, there's going to be a lot of people that are in the same boat that you can kind of connect with. So I encourage you to do that. All right, the first one we're going to look at today is a sci-fi piece from 1959 from the radio show X-1. X-1 was a great little show. It ran from 55 to 1958 on the NBC radio network. And this one is adapted from a Frederick Pohl, I don't know if it was a short story or a novel, and it is called The Tunnel Under the World. So if you want to follow the show notes here and go and listen to this real quick and then come back, we are going to discuss it, and we don't want to spoil anything if you don't want to be spoiled.
Countdown for blast off. X-5. 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
I want to be spoiled.
you've already been spoiled. Okay, and with that, we're assuming you are back, or you're still listening because you don't care about being spoiled, or you've gone and you've listened and now you're back with us. So The Tunnel Under the World by X-1. It's a sort of a Groundhog Day / Dark City mashup, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, that's actually a very accurate description.
And waking up every day screaming, not knowing why, realizes there's something going on. He's remembering something no one else remembering. There's strange mystery afoot, copper under his basement floor. Out of the four that we have, I think this is probably the weakest of the four. It was good, but I think it definitely had more flaws than the others.
Well, yeah. Taking into account the fact that this is actually, I think, probably the only true science fiction one that we listen to in this set. Taking also into account the fact that right now science fiction means something completely different than it did in the 1950s. You know, the ideology of what the future looked like, now we look back on it and say, well, that's completely unrealistic. So we're looking at it, you know, we're looking at it in hindsight. Whereas I feel like if you were somebody that was listening to it at that time, thinking of the potentials being, you know, as they're portrayed in this actual, oh gosh, what do you call it? Montage? What do you call it? this storyline, I guess, is what it is. It would have been a really different impression on you if you were going into it not knowing all of the information that we know here in, you know, 2013, you know, when miniature electronics were just on the cutting edge, for example, you know, and so the shocking and horrifying value of it was at the time that they're recording this, that's when all of that was new. So for us, now we're looking back going, oh yeah, that's just ridiculous. We'd do it a different way. But at that time when, you know, I'm not even educated enough to be able to express this clearly, but you know, when they were just starting to do miniaturization and all of that, this would have been really much more powerful, I think, than we feel it is now looking at it or listening to it rather in hindsight.
Well, I mean, it did presage a lot of culture that went on later. I mean, you know, we're again spoilers, but there's a mention of an atomic explosion in mm-hmm. this thing. You know, so you've got the whole fear of the bomb that really took off, you know, later. You've got, like you said, the miniaturization, the artificial intelligence thing. I mean, there's a lot of themes in science fiction that this thing picks up on that are given more, they're talked about more, you know, in later years as things go forward.
Mm-hmm. Yep, okay, interesting. I just thought that towards the end, they did the twist ending, and then they did the twist ending, and then they did a twist ending. I think maybe...
What you're saying is that we should... we're actually going to turn this into a movie. We should hire I always forget his name. Which Tom is it? The one that it's always stars... Oh, Tom Hanks. So if we're going to make this into a movie, it's going to be Tom Hanks, starring Tom Hanks, directed by Tom Hanks, with Tom Hanks, supporting actors, Tom Hanks.
Yeah,
it's basically a Tom Hanks storyline.
Yeah, something like that.
But you are right. There were a lot of there were actually kind of so many twists that came one after another that it was almost what's a good word for it?
Comical.
Predictable. Or comical works too. Not predictable, but comical. I get that.
Right, and I don't know if that, again, like you were saying, Lydia. I mean, we are looking at these things with, you know, over 40 years of hindsight. So I don't know if it's just our, you know, 2013 view that looks at these twists and go, oh, geez, and really, and that, and, or if it's really something that just was a little weak on the writing, even from the original story. I'm not familiar with the original story, with the Frederick Pohl story. So I'm curious.
I haven't read it either. One of the things I think was weak on the writing with this one was, and we can talk about it later with some of the other episodes, some of the other radio dramas that we're going to talk about, is there's a certain way of writing for these radio dramas. And this story has to resort to a narrator to move the story along, to tell you what you can't see. And that's not maybe the strongest way to tell the story.
Well, I think it's a fair point. Christopher said something about, you know, just the quality of the writing. And that's, I think what you're saying, Steve, is exactly correct, that you can write in such a way that you don't have to have a narrator. But in this case, they didn't. I don't know if it was lack of quality in the writing or lack of quality in the inherent storyline. But, you know, I mean, there are ways that you could have done it so that it wasn't just a strict third-party narrator that may have been a little bit more intense for the listener.
Yeah.
He couldn't shake the thought out of his mind. It persisted all through the day and through dinner. He was still brooding as he and Mary got ready for bed.
Tired, dear?
No.
Anything wrong?
I don't know.
Well, I guess I'll get a good night's sleep. Coming?
I think I'll sit up and read for a while.
Well, good night, darling.
Night, dear.
At exactly midnight, Guy Burkhart lapsed into a sudden, deep sleep. And the following morning, he woke up, screaming.
I will admit, though, that the actual end, I really enjoyed. I really liked the you know, end on, what was the date? You know, April 22nd. So-and-so woke up screaming. And that was
the Carrie ending.
Yeah.
The Carrie ending where, you know, you think it's all over and then, you know, the next, they look in the mirror and it's, if you haven't seen Carrie, I'm sorry, I just spoiled it for you. But it, essentially, yeah, that's exactly what it was, is they bring it back into a circle. So, sort of the horror to that, even though this is technically science fiction, I think, as far as genre goes, the horror to it is that it never ends. You know, for these characters, they never get out of it. They never escape.
Yeah, exactly. And it leads that little hint that maybe the story that we've told, even the discovery of the truth and everything, maybe it's all happened before. Or maybe it's going to happen again.
You just gave me chills. I didn't even think of that one.
Yeah.
I actually really liked, not quite at the very end, but when you kind of figure out finally who the antagonist is. The way it was described, I've always thought, I guess I'm one of those people that like really, I see ants and I think, wow, we must look just like terrifying to them.
Yeah.
So I actually really enjoyed that part of the twist without giving too much away, you know, if you haven't listened to it yet. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was just terribly, now I've already practically given the whole thing away, but I liked that as a twist. I thought that was an interesting one. It wasn't something I was expecting. I kept expecting spaceships.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, another thing, and again, you know, we're going to spoil it. There's no way around this, is, you know, for 19... When did we say this episode?
1959? Broadcast?
59. Mm-hmm.
59? I mean, there's very much an undercurrent here, you know, that the government is conducting this experiment, or the government is complicit in conducting this experiment. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's kind of a radical thing to put out there, you know, in 1959, you know, that questioning all that.
Sure.
Well, and especially, I mean, you had the Cold War going on at the time, and you know, everybody constantly under that perpetual threat of the possibility of nuclear war, and then also to have the idea that your own government, not just the other government, but your own government is involved in it as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Very interesting. Definitely, you know, worth listening to. Like I said, I think there are better X-1 episodes. I have heard a few others, and I hope to review those maybe at a later date, but definitely worth looking up.
And I hadn't heard any, I hadn't listened to any radio dramas in, you know, years and years, but I actually really enjoyed this. This is the first one that I listened to, and I think this is a good one to start with, because it is, you know, especially if you're a science fiction nerd, like we all are, we three, it's entertaining because just the concepts behind it, I think, are entertaining and kind of captivating.
And obviously concepts that have stood the test of time, because as I said, you know, Groundhog Day, Dark City, you know, robots taking over, all that stuff, you know, that carries on, and there are tropes that we see revisited time and time again. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to move on now, and this one is going to be from a radio show called Hollywood Star Time. This would bring Hollywood stars and have them recreate roles and do adaptations of films that they've been in and, you know, turn them into a radio program. So I thought that's kind of an interesting thing to do. This was from 1946, and this particular one was called Shock and stars the incredible Vincent Price.
The enigmatic. I love that word, but I love Vincent Price. I was so excited when they said Vincent Price. Right then I knew I was going to really like this show.
Yeah. So again, follow the link in the show note and go have a listen and then come on back.
You're twice as sure with two great names, Frigidaire and General Motors. Frigidaire presents Hollywood Star Time. Today, for the first time on the air, Shock, starring Vincent Price and Lynn Berry with Michael Dunn.
Shock. The word has been in my brain all night, ever since last night at the Belmont Arms Residential Hotel, where I first saw Janet Stewart suffering from the classic symptoms of shock. Eyes staring blankly, skin cold and moist, pulse weak and rapid, blood pressure falling. Ever since that dreadful moment, I have felt that she knows the truth about me. Richard Cross, M.D. All night, the voice of my professor of psychiatry at medical school has been coming back to me over the years, lecturing on shock.
Shock! Shock, gentlemen, is a nervous reflex, a psychic reaction which normally improves unless maintained by pain and physical or mental abuse.
Remember that.
Shock may be fatal only if not properly recognized and treated. Psychic shock is that type of shock brought on by excessive joy, grief, anger, or fear.
Fear. Was that the cause of Janet Stewart's shock? I must know.
Psychic shock requires psychiatric treatment. All fear and despair must be removed in the patient. A single tactless remark may turn the side against the patient.
A single tactless remark. But time enough for that. After I found out certainly if Janet Stewart saw what I think she saw from her hotel window last night. I must know. Now.
So Vincent Price, you know, played the main character, Richard Cross, who was a doctor. And this was again, you're kind of bringing up, you know, other films that it reminded me of. This is almost like a Rear Window-esque, but in reverse.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on.
We were waiting for you to keep going.
Sorry.
It was funny because I was really excited to listen to it. And as it got going, of course, they grab your attention right away because it's Vincent Price, you know, explaining what's going on and why this woman is in shock. And they start you off guessing. You don't know what it is that, of course, has horrified her into the state of shock, and very quickly find out that, of course, Vincent Price plays the kind of dramatic hero. I feel like I'm going to just narrate the whole thing right now. I just love Vincent Price. Honestly, at this point, I probably could just say, oh, I love Vincent Price, and let you guys finish talking about this. But this, I felt like, was probably the most elaborate plot of the four that we listened to. It seemed to have a lot of characters in it. Mm-hmm. And everything that was in it was necessary to the storyline. Taking in mind, of course, that now I really want to see the film because this is based, you know, was adapted from the film Shock, which was at that time a recent release. But so now, you know, if nothing else, it's a great teaser for the movie.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think I'd like to see it myself.
And the film is also in the public domain, from what I understand. So,
uh-oh.
Look for a future episode of Orphan Entertainment. Well, I definitely would like to see how they handle. There's several moments in this program that it's almost uncomfortable to listen to when Dr. Cross is kind of messing with the character Janet, and he's trying to just unhinge her even more than she already is, and he's making her remember, and then now it's you, and he's hitting you, and it just goes on. It's really intense, and you're like, oh my, you get really uncomfortable. I'd really like to see how they do that on film.
Yeah.
Especially in 1946.
Well, you know, I mean, actually, like Steve was saying, this is, what did you say, the drama of the mind? The theater of the
theater
mind.
Theater of the mind, yeah.
And it's so funny. I mean, I've seen enough Vincent Price films that as they were doing that, I had this really vivid image as I was driving in my car in my mind of exactly how that would be shot on film. So it's interesting because, you know, especially now when we've been exposed to these ridiculous, huge, epic films with like just unbelievable amounts of CG, and they do things now that, you know, 50 years ago nobody would have even imagined. But you can still go back to just a radio program and be listening to it and get completely absorbed in it and have such vivid, you know, images of what's going on between these characters just listening to this radio program.
This definitely is a really good example of what a lot of these radio programs can do, and why I think many people might be easy to discount them because they're just radio programs. But there was an art form to writing these things and then acting them out and doing just like what you were saying, that you could put those images in your mind. You didn't need to see them.
And it didn't have to be directly narrated either. It didn't have to say he walked down the stairs.
Right, yeah. This one didn't have a narrator, right.
Didn't need it. I mean,
no.
Yeah.
Although there was a little bit, I did find some of the Vincent Price, I guess, inner monologue that was going on, and then he was having a flashback, and then he was, oh, listen to that. That's important.
Yeah.
Remember that. Well, yeah. And I think, too, you know, there's a little musical interlude in the middle where obviously they were going to a sponsor's break, which back mm-hmm. then they had sponsors, not advertisers. But, you know, and then when he comes back, it's, you know, you can tell he's priming the audience again, bringing him back to, okay, this is what was happening before the break, or if you just joined us, without right. actually saying, if you just joined us, this is what happened before the break. But, you know, and some of that I think isn't necessary just for, as it was being live aired on the radio, so that, you know, they could capture people's attention again without, you know, if they hadn't been there for the first part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. But as you know, this is something that the 40s are just notorious for. It is, of course, the woman is always the manipulative one.
She was evil. Oh my goodness. Like, and that's why I view Vincent Price as the tragic hero in this, you know. Yeah, I mean, definitely he's not the best person alive in this, but his girlfriend is just, she's the devil. And
yeah.
She's awful.
Well, you could tell right away that she was
Elaine, that was her name.
Elaine, yes. You could tell right away that she was really not right in the head when she discovers, wait, you killed your wife? And that's pretty much it.
And she's like, oh, good.
Oh, okay.
Things are finally going right for us. Wait,
yeah.
What? Only we thought of this sooner.
Yeah, there's one scene where the Vincent Price character, Dr. Cross, he's like, as I was driving over here, I was thinking to myself, was all this really worth it for you? Yeah. And she's like, and he's like, yeah, I think it was. And she's like, good, I'm glad you came to that conclusion. Wow. You know?
If it had been less of a thriller and more of a romantic moment, then at that point he would have taken her into his arms and swept her off in the sunset or whatever. But at that point, yeah, it was just like, here's another syringe. You get this feeling through this whole episode too, that they're in like a creepy mental institution, which is where it's set.
Yes.
But, you know, even the interactions between the characters are kind of just not right. Like you were saying, you know, there's something off about this woman. There's something wrong about all of the interactions between everybody here.
Yeah, you kind of wonder, you know, are the inmates really the ones that are crazy?
Maybe it's the people that are outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so, like you said earlier, that the scenes just end up being so vivid. I can, you know, the scene where they're putting Janet into the coma, you know, I can just see that scene in my head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
See, and remind me now, did they have the actual electricity background sounds going on there? I don't recall.
No, I don't remember any electricity.
Yeah, they never said it was electroshock.
I thought they did. I thought when she was talking about, you know, this accident, that they actually, you know, he said, oh, when he was remembering back to what his professor had said, electroshock therapy if you don't do it right.
No, they referred to it as, they referred to it as carbohydrate shock. Which is utter nonsense. Yeah.
Right. Which we now know is eating too much sugar. So they were putting her in sugar shock is what they were doing. But
yeah, I've been in that shock after a really good big plate of spaghetti. Ooh, oh, carbohydrate shock. Oh, God.
That's what it was. They're bringing her out of a
food. Not anymore. No more ravioli. No.
But no, again, I think a really strong episode. I just, you know, anything that, not to come back to my, you know, obvious crush, but, you know, anything that you see Vincent Price, and he's just, you know, it not only is, and I think Jeffrey Rush has the same quality, to be completely off topic, but they really remind me of each other. But, you know, in everything, you always kind of expect him to be the bad guy, but he always lives up to your expectations in the best way possible. Yeah, so they I think they did a great job adapting this one from the film into the radio.
I had no idea about this story, and I tell you what, I did not know what he was going to do at the end of this. You know, I mean, he goes back and forth, Dr. Cross. He can't bring himself to do the deed, and he can't bring himself to not do the deed. And I didn't know where he was going to end up.
Yeah, it definitely leaves you. It's a great suspense. I think it's appropriately titled thriller as a thriller.
Yeah, and I like that it ends in a very kind of Vincent Price type of ending, where at the end he does the right thing, and the police come for him. It's all been uncovered what he did to his wife, and the police come for him. He's like, okay, well, let me just finish writing this, you know, this report, and he's like, we can go now. It's a very suave and just, it's Vincent Price. Mm-hmm. You know, I did, again, a great ending. You know, the last few lines of this one was probably my favorite part. I just love the way he just ends it like that.
Yeah, this is very well done.
Well, let's switch some gears big time right now and go for something, a much more lighter fare. This one was one that I really enjoyed because I'm a big fan of Abbott and Costello. So we listened to one of the Abbott and Costello shows from 1948. This is when they had moved to ABC Radio in, I think, 47. So this was a little bit after that. So, okay, follow the show, the links in the show note, and go and listen and have a good laugh, and then come back and hear us talk about this one.
Hey, Abbott, what time is it?
It's time for the Abbott and Costello Show. We're on the air for ABC here in Hollywood.
Well, what are we waiting for? Let's go with the Abbott and Costello Show.
Yes, it's the Abbott and Costello Show, produced and transcribed in Hollywood for your listening and laughing pleasure. Chuckles with a carload and music by Matty Malnick. So hold on to your chairs, folks, for here they are, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello.
Hey, Abbott! All right, stop that racket. Where have you been all afternoon?
Where have I been all afternoon? Yeah. I took a tour of the movie stars' homes. I passed Gregory Peck's house and said, gee, I'd like to have his Cadillac. Then I passed Clark Cable's house and I said, gee, I'd like to have his yacht. Then I passed Harry James' house and I said...
Yes?
What would I do with his trumpet? You know, I shouldn't be kidding, Abbott. I mean, after all, I got a threatening letter today. Somebody wants to kill me. Well, that's why I got this.
How many people listen to you every week, Costello?
Well, let me see. All I get about 12 million.
That's amazing.
Then I got... Oh, you mean that I got so many listeners?
No. No, that you only got one threatening letter.
Show me where it says that in the script. Show me where it says that in the script. Hmm. Well, never mind. What are you going to do about the letter? Oh, that's your line. Excuse me.
Never mind. What are you going to do about the letter?
That's where I heard it.
Yeah, that's where I heard it. Well, what are you going to do about the letter, Lou?
Well, the person who sent me that letter, maybe he may be in the audience tonight. I'm going to search everybody out there. I'm going to start with that blonde in the front row.
Don't be silly, Costello. A beautiful girl like that wouldn't be carrying a gun.
You look for what you like, and I'll look for what I like.
December 30th, 1948. This is their last show before the new year, apparently, because that comes up several times. Most of this I really enjoyed. I mean, there was times where I actually laughed out loud.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too.
Those moments when the script fit, where they for whatever reason, they mess up the script, they go off script, the script doesn't work, whatever, and they just go with it, or, you know, Costello just ribs Abbott about a flub. That stuff just kills me every time.
It was like he was almost intentionally just trying to get him.
Yeah. Viola, that was very, very funny, and all I can say to you is what the skunk would say to his brother.
What are the skunks? Skunk.
I still would like to know what page you're on.
What did the skunk say to his brother?
I beg your pardon?
What did the skunk say?
All right, folks, we all go back to page 16.
What did the skunk say to his brother?
Got your teeth back in, eh?
Answer the question, yes or no.
I'll just have it just once more.
What did the skunk say to his brother?
You do too.
You do.
Well, and this is the only episode of these four that is actually shot in front of a live, recorded. There you go, thanks. In front of a live audience. All the others, you can kind of tell a little bit when there's some canned applause going on, but this one is very obviously in front of a live audience.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it gives it a different kind of, it gives it a really different energy.
Yeah, absolutely, because you can feel the energy, you can feel Abbott and Costello playing against the audience.
Exactly.
Instead of just playing against the microphone.
Yeah, and there are parts where, if you're listening for it, you really notice it, but there are parts where just a few people will laugh, and so you can tell there's something going on, and only the sharper people in the audience are catching it,
yeah.
You know, and then there's the really obvious ones where everybody gets a good chuckle out of it, but Chris, I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum from you. I've never been a big Abbott and Costello fan.
Really? No?
Yeah, so I wasn't really thrilled that we're going to be listening to him, but actually I found I was really amused. A lot of the jokes hold up. I was surprised by how many of them hold up.
Yeah.
You know, even they make a couple of jokes, I think, about the government, and that had me, like, laughing out loud. I really was.
Oh, right. They had the one, our congressman, and, you know, I promised to do this. I promised to do that. Oh, so what are you doing now? Nothing. Nothing. Got reelected.
and I know there was one, I wish I could remember the one before that. Totally made me laugh. There's something about, I can't even remember it. But there are several jokes in there that really hold up. He makes a joke about, you know, somebody made a threat about against my life, so I'm going to go search everybody in the audience, starting with that blonde in the front.
Yeah. That type of woman wouldn't carry a gun. You look for what you want to look for. I'll look for what I want to look for.
Yeah. Sure. So there, I think there's a lot of this show that really could come back. There's a little bit of references to really famous actors and actresses at the time. He goes through the list of, you know, the houses of the people that he'd like to have. You know, he drives by Clark Gable's house and thinks, gee, I'd like to have his hair. And then he gets to Harry James' house and, you know, what would I do with this trumpet?
Right.
You only get if you know who Harry James is, and probably saying his name wrong. But, you know, it's a mix. If you're familiar with that era of TV and radio, you'll get a bigger kick, I think, out of it than if you're not.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you're not familiar with it, there's still a lot that holds up.
I was surprised at, you mentioned some of the political humor. I was surprised at the political humor for 1948. Because it sounds a lot like political humor today.
It really did.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that the Times in 1948, that was Truman.
Right.
Truman's famous for the Do-Nothing Congress, right? So
oh.
It's very... That the you know, Congress was in a gridlock and fighting each other, and mm-hmm. and times are very similar to what they are now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the reality, I think, is that, oh gosh, this is about to turn into a political show. But the point being, you know, governments are governments, comedy is comedy, and they really do kind of transcend time. We stand. This is so similar to stand-up comedy now, that it translates really well. It's not a lost art form. It's not something that you have to acquire a taste for to appreciate. It's still a little bit of base humor. You know, you still get a couple of jokes about pretty women and kissing, and you get a couple of jokes about the government, and you know, and it all comes, you know, a couple jokes about money, and it all comes back around because really times don't change that much.
That's right. That's right.
It's always been the simple jokes that always get me the best, and it was the one where Costello's reading. He's got his New Year's resolutions.
Oh. You know,
resolution one: improve my handwriting. Resolution two: what do you know? I can't read it.
Yeah. Like, what does he say? Quit drinking. Quit gambling. And resolution number three is forget the first two.
Love thy neighbor. Next, move next door to Hedy Lamarr.
Right.
Yep. Again, they were just such masters of the comic timing. You know, he knew how to give the lines, and yeah, a lot of fun.
My only complaint on this one is I thought his Sam Shovel routine went on a little long. I mean, I think it was probably the entire last half of the program. And it was kind of a cute joke that went way too far.
Now, is it just me, or I'm fairly new to Abbott and Costello. Was that an actual program he had, or was
no,
it just?
No, I don't believe so. No, I think it was just for his radio program. Maybe it was a reoccurring character or a bit that they did. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, obviously, it was supposed to be sort of like a Sergeant Friday sort of thing. I'm Sam Shovel. You know, I'm a cop. I'm a detective, whatever, and
I talk in monotone.
Yeah, I talk in monotone, and yeah, it just goes
on. It was a spoof of all the, you know, the film noir was very big in those days, and yeah, it was a spoof of those film noir detectives, the private eyes kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I knew what he was going for, and why. It just, I felt like it just it drug on a little long for me.
Well, I didn't realize it wasn't a real thing.
No, you really thought there was like an Abbott and Costello Sam Shovel movie,
yeah,
or something? Yeah.
I did. So it didn't occur to me to question it. You know, it had its couple of funny moments. I felt like that would have been one that would have been really funny if it had been in film, because the facial expressions and the
mm-hmm.
you know, the story behind it and the guy's watch and all of that.
Right.
You know, it was something that it could have been added to with. So probably if you're there in a live audience watching it, it was probably hilarious.
Yeah, probably. They eventually did go to television and do the Abbott and Costello show, again, in front of a live audience and in front of the camera. And I wonder if, you know, Sam Shovel was a character that they ever tried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very possible. Well, and it sounded like they had just moved, probably with the move with ABC, they probably had gone out to California, where they had been before on the East Coast. Does that sound mm-hmm. accurate?
I think they were always on the West Coast.
Were they?
Yeah. Not, but don't quote me. I'm not exactly.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure.
We'll look it up.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone can go hit your Google right now. Yeah.
Exactly. That's what the internet is for.
Yeah. But so one. It's up. I know, you know, Abbott and Costello, I guess, isn't for everybody. I always get a kick out of them. So it was a lot of fun for me. And like I said, I like the comedy routines when, you know, things just don't go right and they just play with it. Either they go with it or like in this one where they just point it out.
Those are the funniest. Anytime you're watching the Carol Burnett show or, you know, Saturday Night Live or Friday Night. Oh, gosh. Friday Night. I forgot what it is. Anyway, but all of those, when somebody misses their line or misses their cue, is always when it's the funniest. When they crack each other up, oh, laughing is a classic example.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, absolutely.
Any time that they would crack each other up is far funnier than the script, and you just,
yep.
you know, you could just be crying, laughing. And in this case, those are the funniest moments, too.
Yep. Well, we are going to switch back to a little darker tone with the Murder at Midnight program doing The House Where Death Lived. Let's see, Murder at Midnight ran on ABC Radio from 1946 to 1947. And this one was done in 1946. So follow the link in the show note and come on back.
It's not just an ordinary cane, my dear.
Alec.
It's a sword cane, see? Calhoun used it when he killed his wife, right where you're standing.
Alec, you killed Sanders.
Exactly.
And now you're going to kill me.
Yes.
No, no, no. Keep away from me.
Sorry.
Keep away.
My dear.
Midnight. The witching hour when the night is darkest, our fears the strongest, and our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes. How? You'll learn the answer in just a minute in The House Where Death Lived.
So The House Where Death Lived, this is probably, I don't know, this was an interesting one. I kind of liked it, and this is another one we had talked about where we'd kind of like to see how they would do it in film. This one, I don't know, maybe it has been done in film at some point.
I think they did it in film, and it was called Rose Red.
Yeah?
I'm just kidding. I'm just joking.
I don't know. Okay.
Definitely, I could see where it would have been, this radio program could have been a very strong influence to something like that.
Yep. But, I mean, this has, you know, starred the very much, you know, the old-fashioned haunted house. And it had kind of almost a haunting feel from the you know, 1963 film The Haunting,
mm-hmm.
where the, you know, someone's going to investigate and try to, you know, he wants to investigate the spectral, I don't remember what he called it, paranormal investigation stuff.
Parapsychic, I think they call
parapsychic, it. Parapsychic, was that it? Yeah.
Oh, they call it, I think they call it three or four things.
Yes, and this was, you know, the Dr. Goth. What a great name.
I was wondering if I'd heard that wrong.
Yeah. When did goth become, you know, a term? I mean, this was in the 40s. Was it being used to describe something, you know, dark and macabre by
not
then?
Not abbreviated, I don't think. I mean, gothic is obviously a term from the 1700s. But, you know, the gothic thrillers from those days, of course, obviously in literature, not in radio.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think a lot of the time they'll take iconic images and turn them into last names. And I think they probably did the same thing with this doctor.
Okay. Not related to the goth, like I'm thinking goth, like goth chicks or something.
No, probably yeah. Gothic, as in that dark.
Both the same core idea, but not really necessarily related to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They both are derived, I think, from the same word.
You go. Derived. Very good. Yeah, but this was pretty cool, although I do think our Dr. Goth jumps to the idea of murder pretty quickly in this.
Yeah, I thought that.
It was like in the first 10, 15 minutes.
Runs off this chain of conclusions here, and, you know, well, he clearly manifested himself in the house, but, well, maybe he couldn't come back, and so it's just this chain of conclusions.
Right, yeah.
So I should kill somebody. What?
If this were a comedy routine, it would be Eddie Izzard saying, I can't get the trees right, damn, I would kill everyone. You know, just out of the blue, like, just one little thing, and all that's it, all of a sudden I'm Hitler.
And I love his reasoning behind it all. Science is a harsh mistress.
Yeah. It's always the woman's fault. Why do you always blame us? Science is a man, I tell you. No. But yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think the one really big hitch, I think, in this one for me was you going from, oh, he's not back, you know, well, what should I do? I know, I'll kill somebody. Most people, I don't think, would make that next natural step into now, murder.
Right. And in the end, it's kind of explained that the house drives people to murder, but we don't see it. You know, we don't hear it. We don't get any of that in the story. It's just sort of told in retrospect or something, and it doesn't really work.
Well, it works, obviously, because he kills them.
Well, but... yeah, well, yeah, that no, works.
I know what you're saying.
For the story, though.
It's a little bit of a leap, but I mean, let's talk a little bit about the technical side of it. Maybe not technical, but as far as the storyline itself goes, aside from that one kind of glaring leap of faith,
mm-hmm.
You know, it definitely, this is intended as a horror, and it's very horrifying. I mean, you have this man who presumably instantly is going into this, you know, house to explore, just to, you know, explore the psychic part of it, and then, you know, very quickly gets sucked in, and it was, you know, I kind of love when he's first being given that, the tour of the house, you know.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
We should start with the cellar, because that's where you always start when you're giving somebody
right,
a tour,
sure.
Right? You know, you're not like, oh, this is the kitchen and this is the dining room. You're like, oh, let's go see the cellar, you know?
Right, yeah.
So, you know, and not only let's go see the cellar, but this is the first place where somebody murdered. Oh, let's go see the next room where somebody was murdered, you know?
Yeah. It's not here, like, and here's the murder weapon that's still here.
The murder weapon. Take it in your hand, you know, there, feel it.
Yeah, there's a stain on the carpet, for that's his blood.
Sleep with it.
Yeah.
Right. Over here is a piece of hair that I saved. I mean, yeah, it's very, it's a little awkward. One of the characters I really enjoyed listening to was Calhoun. For some reason, just the voice actor really caught my attention just as soon as he gets on. I love it that he's kind of underplayed in it, that he's, you know, he sounds like this, to me, he sounded like this kind of frail, timid guy that you just, I at first thought, oh, this is the caretaker, and then I thought, this is the creepy caretaker, and then I thought, this is the creepy caretaker that killed everybody. When you figure out who he is, then you're like, oh, no, he's just creepy. So, but no, I enjoyed him a lot. I was a little surprised by the wife when Goth's wife shows up, and I expected her to be like, the sweet tragic heroine, and instead she's this bossy, horrible woman. And you're kind of like, well, now I get why he jumps to the conclusion of murder. He's been like this horrible woman this whole time that's like, oh, just give it up, Henry. Come back. Come home. I'm tired. Why aren't you ever home? I need dinner tonight. You know, you're not quite like that, but I mean, she's just horribly bossy and pushy. Why didn't you come tell me the chauffeur was dead? Oh, wham, me. I was like, when she was gone, I was kind of like, I kind of can't blame him. I was surprised they didn't get rid of her first, actually.
Yeah.
But no, they're definitely the main, and I don't know who the main guy was, the main voice actor in this, but, you know, he and the Calhoun character and the wife, I thought, were all very strong, very well done. The chauffeur, I thought, was a little on the, maybe a little forced. Maybe he was just, you know, kind of
yeah, a little panto. Yeah, I got it, because he's the first one to die. And, yeah, you get that weird, you know, oh, well, yes, go in the basement real quick. Hurry, hurry. Okay, I'll go, but I don't know. Whoa! It's like, yeah. And it wasn't much more convincing than that.
No, it really was.
I don't hear anything. Just the storm.
Listen hard. There it is again. It's down in the cellar.
Where's that?
It's back there.
Where?
Go ahead, run. You're quicker than I am, Sanders. Run, hurry.
Okay, but I still don't hear anything.
You get, I mean, I definitely felt like in this one, when you're watching some of these, you get these really vivid images and it's captivating and you're just waiting for the next thing to happen. On this one, you kind of feel like you're watching a
Wayans movie.
Yeah. Well, a slightly badly done movie from the 30s. You know,
yeah.
They throw their hands up and then fall over and it's
yeah.
and they grab their chest. And, but, you know, so the quality's not quite as high as a couple that we've listened to tonight, you know, previously tonight.
Right.
But at the end of it, I thought was really good on the horror.
Oh,
end.
Again, yeah, the ending really saves it for me.
Yeah.
The whole twist that this your house, you're cursed, and you know you have to kill in order to, or get someone to kill before you can be released. If your spirit is stuck in this house, you have to get someone else to kill so your spirit can be released, and then their victims will haunt the house, and then it's just this cycle that goes on. Like, oh, I like that.
And then your victims literally hold you in the house,
right? That's so you cool. can't leave.
That was lovely. I thought, you know, because up until then I was like, oh, well, you just leave the house, you know, and
right.
And then you know he's there, and you know, you obviously the fire's lit, and you know that this is gonna end somehow. But then he's stuck there, and it's just that to me is the horror part. You know, is where. He to his own detriment by leaping maybe to these huge conclusions and being so easily drawn into it, obviously is, you know, nailing the lid on his own coffin, to use an idiom.
Yeah.
Actually, literally, probably in this case. But but no, I thought, you know, yeah, I think I agree with you that the end definitely saves it. It's still, I think, a pretty captivating story, just in general, again, with all of the rose reds and the hauntings and things that we've seen now, there's not much shocking in this one, but it's definitely the end of it. You know, again, the end of it saves it. Definitely is a little bit horrific.
Yes, absolutely. Alrighty, well, I think that is going to do it for this episode. These are four great, a lot of fun. You know, you ought to go check them out. Like I said, they're only a half an hour a piece, so it's an easy listen.
I was surprised. I especially listening to a couple of these, I wanted to listen to more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'll come back on next month and I'll be like, oh my gosh, I've been doing nothing but listening to radio.
Well, I actually queued up quite a number more myself after I listened to these. So,
listening to radio programming, I'm saying killing people and burying them in my basement because that's what I'll be doing this.
No.
We'll start a horror podcast, and you listen to this podcast, and you have to kill someone before you can
before your spirit is released. Or
yeah.
this is the cane with the sword.
This is the microphone that he strangled himself. No.
The cord. You know what's really going to happen is next month I'll be like, Christopher, why haven't you called me in the last month?
Shut up, Lydia.
No, I'm tired of you dabbling in this stupid podcast.
Shut up, damn you. Shut up.
We could do one of these.
Yep, absolutely. But as always, I want to thank everyone for listening. Next month, I'm not sure what we're going to do. We're going to be a little tight on time next month. We have got a big sci-fi horror convention coming up in April that all three of us are going to be involved in. So, yeah. So we will try to squeeze and get an episode in at some point for April. We may end up going back and doing Shock because that's really curious. That got me curious.
Yeah, I'm pretty interested to know kind of how that works out.
Yep.
And that might be, you know, hey, maybe we'll shoot it live from the science fiction convention.
Ooh, that's an idea.
There you go. All right. Well, we will put our heads together and we'll see what we can do. Until then, thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed as much as we did, and we will catch you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.